This is a content warning for discussion of state and military violence, including that against women and gender minorities. This is not described in detail, but is touched on a number of times.
Saturday morning, I take a turn at the skillet. I burn some eggs, boil coffee, drink a cup, then refill it. I read some pages of the paper, mostly look at the pictures. There's a drip at the faucet, so I fumble with the fixture. We take our own showers, wash our own hair, make our own beds, push in our own chairs. I thought all this stuff would get done for me. A robot mows the lawn while I sit under a tree. I thought we'd control wind and rain, cure all sickness, eliminate pain. I wanted mind reading gadgets to cater to my wishes. Wanted self cleaning kitchens and non sticking dishes. We're the end of war, free from disease. We're the milk and uneasy shining sea, and we're all the crime free cities. Rockets on our backs, and we're on the smooth-moving sidewalks. It wears my jet.
Kia ora, hello comrades, and welcome to Where's My Jetpack? I'm Arnie White.
And I'm Derek Johnson. Hola, comrades. This month is widely recognized as the 10th anniversary of the Syrian Revolution. So we're interviewing Syrian-American activist Razan Ghazaoui on women's liberation and the revolution. But first, some recs. Ani.
We've read this before, but the books Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War by Leila El-Shami and Robin Yassin Kassab, and also The Impossible Revolution by Yassin Al-Haj Saleh, both well worth reading. And the Alliance of MENA, or Middle Eastern North African Socialists, have a number of very good videos of international forums and discussions. And so I particularly recommend Feminist Politics and the Syrian Revolution, which features our guest for this month, Razan Ghazaoui, as well as a number of other speakers. And they have a lot of those sorts of international forums of activists in various, you know, continents, various countries, like very worthwhile sort of educative forums. So, yeah, the Alliance of MENA Socialists.
Yeah, it's a very good resource. I also want to link to Counter Vortex by Bill Weinberg. That has some pretty good articles over there and republishings. For instance, like this one, Russiagate, Syria and the Left by Terry Burt with the Committee and the Solidarity with the People of Syria, CISPOS, in Minneapolis. And the website for that organization is www.cispos.org/. And also I want to recommend Bellingcat website. They do a lot of really good content, and they're constantly being attacked by tankies and NASBOLs as working for the State Department or the CIA, which is a crock of shit. And I especially want to recommend their piece, Pro-Assad Lobby Groups Reward Bloggers on Both the Left and the Right, that exposes red-brown propagandists for Assad monetarily rewarding them with the Serena Shim Award. And there's winners like Jimmy Dore, the comedian turned toxic political commentator who has been calling for a left-right populist alliance, like with the Boogaloo Boys. He won the award and was paid $2,500. You can check his IRS statements if anybody thinks that's a lie, as well as any of these other people. Visiting guests of the regime included Tulsi Gabbard and Dennis Kucinich, who once ran for president of the United States.
Yeah, and I recommend the documentary Women of Syria, Unheard No More by Amnesty International. original.
And I want to also recommend a reprint that Counter Vortex did of a piece by Leila Al-Shami on Omar Aziz, the Syrian anarchist, which is an excellent history of an actual Syrian anarchist and the movement building he helped start with Western leftists, ignoring, unfortunately, the Syrian local councils. Omar Aziz was born in Damascus. He returned to Syria from exile in Saudi Arabia and the United States in the early days of the Syrian Revolution. An intellectual, economist, anarchist, husband, and father. At the age of 63, he committed himself to the revolutionary struggle. He worked together with local activists to collect humanitarian aid and distribute it to suburbs of Damascus that were under attack by the regime. Through his writing and activity, he promoted local self-governance, horizontal organization, cooperation, solidarity, and mutual aid as the means by which people could emancipate themselves from tyranny of the state. Together with comrades, Aziz founded the first local committee in Barzay, Damascus. The example spread across Syria, and with it some of the most promising and lasting examples of non-hierarchical self-organization to have emerged from the countries of the Arab Spring. In her tribute to Omar Aziz, Budar Hassan says, he, quote, did not wear a vendetta mask, nor did he form black blocks.
Yeah, and as always, we'll link these in the blog post at jetpack.zoob.net. Before we move on to the interview, just a note, as well as being the official 10th anniversary of the Syrian Revolution, this is also the second anniversary of the Christchurch shooting in Aotearoa, New Zealand, when a far-right terrorist targeted two mosques and took out 50 people. Some of those attacked were themselves Syrian refugees. We remember the dead and fight for the living. We also have another bonus episode released today with video essayist Byron Clark on the far right in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Cool Thought segment. We're interviewing Razan Ghazawi on the Syrian Revolution. Razan is an award-winning human rights defender and blogger, an exiled Palestinian Syrian US-based scholar activist, and a doctoral researcher in gender studies at the University of Sussex. Her thesis looks at different forms of mobilization of queerness in the context of the war on terror in the Syrian war. Ghazawi was detained twice by the Syrian state and was exiled by Al-Qaeda and ISIS groups in northern Syria. She is the founder of the Feminist Archives, that's with a Q, and a co-founder of the Karama Bus Project in Idlib. Welcome to the show, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us about the early days of the revolution, which is sort of widely talked about as beginning 10 years ago today?
Yeah, thanks for that. So a lot to be said actually about those moments. I like to talk about them as moments because it really it's kind of a very different kind of form of protest. Like when it started in Tunisia and in Egypt, a lot of people in Syria, like at least in where I was in Damascus and the people around me, I'm talking about some bloggers because I was blogging at the time, some filmmakers, some artists. So like me and the community around me were kind of like really wanted to protest and really wanted to be on the streets. And we did start a sort of solidarity protest, and this is very important idea, is that how the protest started in Syria. They started in solidarity, in Damascus at least, in solidarity with Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions. And then throughout these protests and throughout these, let's just say not protests, but kind of like solidarity sit-ins really, it kind of shifted towards more of a protest demanding the state itself condemn what's happened in Daraa, for example, in the 18th of March, when children were tortured, and some of them were tortured to death, like Hamza al-Khatib and others, because they were drawing graffiti on their schools. So it's kind of like the idea of, you know, advocating for children's rights is essential idea when we're thinking about the protests in Syria. And also when we're thinking about the protests in Syria in those earlier days, we also need to be thinking about solidarity as a notion, not just within the Syrian the state or geography, but also across North Africa and West Asia region. And I wanted to kind of quickly just to kind of talk about the debate that's been happening, like, when did the revolution start in Syria? There's like a debate which is referred to sometimes as a kind of a city-centered debate, city-centered side, and one is kind of more of a suburb-centered side, in the sense that some people would say, oh no, the protest started in February in Damascus, and others would say, no, actually the protest started in Daraa, which is the periphery of like the kind of outside the center. And I'm just finding it like the kind of either-or narratives or either-or kind of solutions, or it doesn't have to be either-or. We can say, you know, protests develop in different ways in Damascus, and how would they develop in Daraa? We can just easily embrace the protests that happened in Damascus as well as in Daraa. And this is kind of my approach, is that really we cannot say, you know, the protests or the sit-ins that happened, the movement that happened in Damascus, we should erase them just because it's a center, because it has a different kind of symbolic or symbolism really against the state, which is difficult to protest in Damascus, the capital, as it was in Daraa. So in that sense, this is how I personally view the earlier days of the uprising.
Yeah, and you were imprisoned twice, triggering an international solidarity campaign. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was in detention and prison at the time, and I remember, you know, in detention and prison, as it was the case in a lot of authoritarian military states, you're in prison or in detention, you're cut outside of information, you don't know what's happening outside. So I had no idea there was international solidarity campaign until I was released. And when I was released, I remember I logged into my Facebook and I saw like a lot of people adding me as a friend request, and I was a bit overwhelmed with the solidarity campaign. And I think I'm very thankful for my readers and my friends, bloggers. And I think I've been blogging since 2005 in Damascus, from Damascus, and I also started in Arabic, but then I shifted in English because there was a lot of bullying for how I was talking a lot about sexual harassment and LGBTQ kind of content. So I was not able to write in Arabic, and I shifted into English. And I think that shift kind of made me more accessible to wider readership. And I think that affected why there was a huge campaign, I guess. I'm very thankful. And at the same time, I have used that access to talk about other detainees.
Great, thank you for sharing. Your research concerns the role of LGBT struggle in the Syrian revolution. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, so this is like an ongoing process. I am personally kind of more looking into the idea of surveillance. How do we think about surveillance, and how do we think about security in Syria when we more kind of think about those issues from a perspective of LGBTQ positionalities and subjectivities? So how do people actually who have a kind of a different or non-normative gender and sexual kind of identities and expressions, how do they experience checkpoints? In my thesis, like, I focus on checkpoints because they were like an emergent kind of form of surveillance that they have appeared and occurred in the uprising. They were used by the state to kind of hunt down protesters. They wanted to close the connections, the bridges between certain neighborhoods. They were kind of collaborative in terms of aid, in terms of also kind of smuggling activists who are wanted. So there's a lot of forms of solidarity, also forms of activism that happened across neighborhoods, across cities and suburbs. And the checkpoints were really there to kind of cut and rupture those connections. So this is what I'm trying to do in my thesis. I'm trying to, through the life histories and kind of interviews and ethnographic research, and trying to capture those kind of nuances. What happens when we think about checkpoints from the perspective of a trans woman or as someone who's a femme gay or a butch or any person who's just kind of for first time they're in a direct kind of, well, not the first time really, but let's just say there's like different kind of interactions depending on where you are with the state. Some of my interlocutors tell me that in Latakia, no one would talk to you if you're if you look gay, whatever that means. People in Damascus would have different stories to tell about that. You know, there's more security, there's more surveillance. So I'm trying to kind of look at all of those kind of connections and debates and seeing how they connect together. And I'm still in writing up process, so I'm all over the place with my topic and my thesis. I kind of like it takes some time to make sense of everything.
And it's not something that I've seen a lot of sort of writing on or discussion of as the role of LGBT struggle in the revolution. So yeah, I understand that. I'm in the middle of my PhD myself, so it can be hard to talk about it midstream, but it's good to get, you know, an impression of where you're at with that research. Very interested to see how that turns out. But can you talk about the phases of militarization and how they have affected women in the revolution?
Yeah. So it's also a debate about the phases of the militarization. And I would say, you know, I would maybe say there's a like kind of a mainstream debate, like a mainstream perspective. Like there's a general idea that, people had to carry arms and to protect themselves. And I do think that this is correctly part of the narrative. This is essentially very important. Yes, people did. I mean, this the Syrian state, and they have used and monopolized, kind of weaponized every single element of the state, a state infrastructure, the state hospitals, the state, like there was no safe space to go to. With the campus, it was not safe. I have colleagues who have been tortured to death on campus. I have friends who have been disappeared on the universities. Like students were beaten on campus. There's really no sense of safety in any state institution during the uprising. And this is in the early on, like people are protesting, students, workers, and the state has like increasingly started to use weapons and the thugs, and also escalated. And this is what pushed some communities to defend themselves. And I think this is a very important acknowledgement to say that communities did want to protect their communities from the army, the Syrian state army. But also at the same time, I am really worried of just talking about this narrative, because even though it is true, but it is not the full story. And I think the reason why we need to talk about how communities defend themselves, but also we need to talk about what do other players in the region and worldwide would benefit from putting arms in, let's just say, some of the communities who are eager to defend themselves. So and I think this is why I think it's very important to be critical from the early on to the role of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and also Turkey and how and Muslim Brotherhood specifically. I mean, Muslim Brotherhood, they did want to try to gain political grounds by militarization and by putting arms in the hands of some of the revolutionaries on the ground. So this kind of narrative, when we're talking about the state violence and how communities are trying to protect themselves, I think it's very important to remember the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, the role of the Gulf, the role of Erdogan also trying to push for militarization to co-opt the uprising. And I think this this is where I disagree with some of the experts and some of the, let me just say, diaspora-based experts on Syria, who see only one narrative and trying to romanticize the struggle as if we're just kind of pushed toward militarization. Not exactly is the full truth. People were also trying to resist militarization and trying to stick to nonviolence because they knew and they understood this is not the strength of the movement. But, you know, things get complicated, and this is why a lot of them, they were bullied, you know, nonviolent, anti-violent. And also there are some of them like Mohajer Qahaf, for example, who's really had a visionary kind of, and also like Razan Zaitouneh and others who've been really visionary feminists and visionary human rights advocates and writers who would see the, you know, while we need to defend ourselves, but at the same time, we need to be careful of how militarization would affect not only women, but also communities in the long run. And this is true. I mean, as you said with your question, I mean, a lot of the people, like, you know, I do not identify as a woman, I identify as a non-binary femme. But we can say that a lot of the people who are non-normative, they're not cis men, they're not, you know, macho, also, you know, masculinities, even femme masculinities were also not welcomed as to be part of the uprising. So it is, you know, it is something that, you know, a lot of challenges that social movements go through. And it's only the nuances and people from within the movement who are wary about these conflicts that need to really be advocating how to get out of them and how to address them rather than to just kind of sugarcoat them and romanticize them. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we have a lot of work to do on that front of how to really trace how the militarization of the movement did affect communities on the long run and farmers and workers and non-conforming people, not just, you know, politically, but also in gender and racially and class-wise. So this is kind of like debate that I feel is very important to think about these questions when we think about militarization.
How did the revolution become sectarianized?
It's a big question. I definitely cannot answer that fully, but I personally, I would just say definitely, I remember very well. I mean, again, like when we're thinking about social movements, a new space has emerged, a new space is open, and that's made a lot of people wanted to co-opt that space. And I think this is what happened. I think what happened is that a lot of people, like, for example, Al-Aroor is a personality, as a character, he's a public figure who has used really his money and his connections to kind of disseminate really sectarian discourse early on in the uprising. And that what made a lot of people actually withdraw and critical and scared to join, specifically people who are also scared movements in Syria. So, I'm very, like, at the time, there was a lot of people who wanted to talk about the danger of this and harm of this discourse, and there were a lot of efforts to combat this hatred. But again, with the militarization, things got really out of control. And I think this is the curse of militarization, is that you have little really space to, you don't have a lot of as powerful tools to kind of convince, or rather to kind of like combat this kind of extremist or takfiri, as I'd like to call them, movement. So I think that sectarianism is something that need to, and I would say racism and patriarchy and classism, they all need to be thought about specifically as anti-revolutionary, as counter-revolutionary culture, and that we need to really think about challenging.
Yeah, I think there's a case to be made that there's kind of two forms of counter-revolution that have occurred. The sort of, obviously, the brutal counter-revolution from the Assad regime, but then the issue of kind of internal counter-revolution, and that's maybe a more difficult question in a way. But can you talk about the Kurdish struggle?
So I am personally, I'm someone who, I mean, this is a very important thing to say. I mean, I'm learning. I'm someone who's been living under dictatorship, military dictatorship all my life. I was isolated from the Kurdish struggle. We were brought up to believe we're all Arabists and we're all Arabs. So the idea is very new to me personally, as someone who is learning about my communities and different communities are living in Syria. So I do not I do not see myself as an expert, but what I can say is that what I've learned from the Kurdish struggle in Syria, I would say from early on in 2012, when the FSA had started to gain kind of control and they're starting to, there was a case, I don't remember when, but in 2012, when the FSA wanted to get into Kurdish areas and Kurdish dominated villages, and there was I remember a lot of people that I respect on Facebook, they shared posts saying that this is very dangerous when the Arab backed kind of revolutionaries, they would go into Kurdish dominated areas under the pretext of liberating it, that would create a lot of tension in the long run. And I think this is a very important sensitivity that a lot of the Arab revolutionaries do not reflect on. There's a lot of hatred, a lot of racism. I'm talking as someone from within the movement. I'm not talking about, a lot of people, like I would say diasporic, again, going back to diasporic conversation, the debate about the Kurdish struggle is very much, if no, kind of orientalist, I would say. I mean, this is something I talked about in my article in Al Jazeera English, is how to be critical of social movement, but at the same time also careful of how this could lead into hatred towards the Kurds. For example, in an Arabist culture that the Assad regime has been advocating, and the practices, the anti-Kurdish practices and anti-indigenous practices that's been happening in Syria against the Kurds and against the indigenous communities. We're talking about also Assyrians. We're talking about a lot of indigenous communities. And this is something that this hysterical oppression of Kurds, that not to be used their language, not to use their culture, not to have their children to be named their Kurdish names. They had to be named Arabic names. They cannot own, they cannot work. I mean, all of these kind of struggles that the Kurdish people, Syrian Kurdish people, have suffered long before Hafez came. I mean, this is also important to say. Is something that I think Arab opposition, Arab revolutionaries don't think about as much. And I think we have a lot more work to learn about each other. This is a revolutionary work. When you dismantle dictatorship and the military in a way that you would reflect on your own privileges, as someone who is an Arab in Syria, even though, well, let's just say privilege is not really the right word here, but let's just say more access than the Kurdish citizens or stateless, actually, people. I think that is very important revolutionary thinking that I don't think we do as much.
And what role have the various international states played in Syria?
With this, how can the community, I call it the war on Syrians. I mean, this is how I call it. It's just Syrian war is a war on Syrians, a war on the people in Syria. In the partition, the conflict, the proxy war. I mean, it's a co-optation of a movement. It is how a popular movement, how a just movement has turned into a war, and how people who have been protesting with so much agency and so much, kind of energy to think about the future and to build that future, and how today has been faced to deal with the consequences of the war methods that the Assad and their allies have started and chose.
Yeah, there are obviously so many states that have played kind of various roles.
That's a big question, really.
Yeah, that's been the big problem, and I think that's played into a lot of the reactionary propaganda of just like writing off the revolution as just proxy wars and the U.S. or somebody just doing a regime change and that kind of talk. What remains of the democratic revolution either in Syria or the diaspora?
This is where I like to talk about moments or like revolutionary moments, not a revolution that has a time frame that when it began, when it ended. I'm not really in favor of thinking about revolutions like that. I'm kind of thinking about revolutions as a constant movement. It happens. So, like protesting in Damascus in 2011 in March or February, this is how protest was. But now, 10 years later, it could be something else. It does not mean it ended, Like, people have changed forever. I have a very strong belief that people who protested once in front of scary powers, like military and states, I do believe that people who've done that in their lifetime, they can always, and they are always protesters. I mean, as a PhD student, I protested against my first supervisory team. You know, I changed my supervisors. I know a lot of students in my school did not do that. So, I mean, when I hear the stories, like students are scared to change their supervisory teams because this is how academic, you know, kind of work does. You know, this is what happened. You just have to accept that you just have to deal with it. But I did not. And because I protested once, I will always protest, whether in academia, whether in any other place or space. This is why I don't think the revolution ended. I feel that people who... They're creative. They have different forms of protest. They have different forms of, and this is true. I mean, I do feel that today, the care. You know, a lot of communities, they care about their children. They care about their relatives. They care about sending support and solidarity. They care about, you know, caring about. Let's just help my friend to get to Europe. All these forms, I feel, they're forms of protest. I mean, this is why my PhD really looks at kind of non-binary way of protest. How can we think about protest away from the mainstream idea that a revolution it only happens inside the country, or the revolution only happens when there's a people marching in the street. I'm not saying that I am positive about the future. I'm definitely 10 years older than I was before. I mean, I'm also very tired and I'm very burned out, and I'm still healing, you know, from the past 10 years. So a lot of people are like that. So I just feel like I'm a different person, and I'm only talking about myself. And I'm a stubborn person, you know, and I feel like a lot of people are like that. So I do feel that people who are healing and they're taking a break, they will make other revolutions in the next 10 years. That's how I personally see it.
Yeah, it's been good to see. I mean, the recurrence of some of these uprisings in Lebanon as well. And so you worked with Raed Fares of Radio Fresh in Idlib, and he was assassinated by Al Qaeda, and you also had your own troubles with Al Qaeda and ISIS in northern Syria. Can you tell us about this?
After my release and a second detention, I decided to leave Damascus because I was burned out from detention and I could not do it again. And I was told that I wanted for detention and a third detention because I was explaining to you the work we were doing with Lina and Ana Uday in between Yarmouk camp in Damascus, specifically around medicine and aid. So after I decided to go to Kaframbel in Idlib, Raed told me you can stay, you can do your work, and I decided to co-found a Karama Bus project, which is a psychosocial support project. It's kind of provide like an alternative education to IDPs, children, internally displaced children. In Idlib, in the area at the time, we're talking about, I went there in December 2012 and I stayed there until at the end of 2013. So we're talking pretty much like in the whole 2013 year. So it's really like at the area at the time, it was newly liberated. A lot of families have left their villages and they went to take shelter in schools. So there was a lot of large number of families living in schools, and a lot of large number of children who do not go to schools, and also they do not have access to like play. So what we did is that we were a bus of four people, and we used to go to six villages in Idlib, and we used to we had a projector. We screened cartoons, songs. We also played sport with the kids. We used to go there around sunset, so there was a little bit of sun there. We played sport, and then we start preparing to screen some cartoons. And we stay there for a couple of hours, and we go back home. So that kind of movement every day for a week, it kind of brought some headache from ISIS, which was towards the middle and the end of 2013. I started to get people coming over, say, I was not veiled at the time. I refused to wear the veil. And I used to get people coming to me, to my office, telling me that sister, you need to put your veil on. It's not, you know, it's a provoking people. And of course, when I say provoking people, we're not talking about communities. People have been working with me, and people, families and their mothers and their kids, they're all accepting me. It's just the ISIS and Nusra. And also, I have to say, if I say were not accepting of me at the time, of me being like a non-conforming female assigned at birth and who's non-veiled. So, and on that was on the one hand. On the second hand, also Ra'id, he was very much vocal against extremists, and he was very much advocate of secularism. And he used to talk about that and used to draw Kafran Bil Banner. So there was a lot of really kind of tension in the air, you know, what we wanted, and at the same time, what it was, the power on the ground and how it's changing due to militarization. So what happened afterwards is really me and Ra'id were on a tour towards the end of 2013 in the US. We're trying to speaking about Syria, speaking about Kafrembe, we're talking about our work. And then we hear that our colleagues in Kafrembe were raided by ISIS, were raided and they were kidnapped. And our toys, our tools were confiscated. Our laptops, our projector that we're just telling you, it was all confiscated by ISIS. Even the toys were smashed and broken, and our office was broken. So this is why I was not able to go back to Kafrembe after this raid. And this happened after several times of, like, you know, people coming to Ra'id and coming to my office to kind of warn us about our discourse. So that's when Ra'id told me, Razan, you should not come back until you, like, unless you are veiled. And that's what he said. And that's when I decided I'm not going to come back veiled. And Ra'id survived the first attempt to assassination attempt. And since then, that was in I think it was early 2014. And he remained underground, not even going to his place, not even seeing his kids and his wife. He remained underground for 2 years, escaping ever since that assassination attempt, until he was killed with Hamoud in 2018 while doing my fieldwork and my PhD fieldwork in Beirut, in Lebanon at the time. So it was Ra'id is someone who is, I call him an intellectual and a community organizer. There's so much to be written about Ra'id and people like Ra'id. I don't think, even though a lot has been said about Ra'id, I don't think he's been, like, appreciated enough the way that what he did and what he done, and how much he had. He was a mayor, in my view. He was a Kafrembe mayor. He was an excellent mayor. He knew how to internationalize Kafrembe in a way to talk about solidarity of the revolution. Kafrembe was one of the earliest villages to be in solidarity with the Kurdish struggle. I do not endorse all of their banners. Some of their banners, I think I disagree with it. We don't want to romanticize each other's work as well. I mean, I'm very critical of romanticization and making people look perfect. We're not perfect. We have a lot of issues we need to talk about, but For the most part, we did our best, and Ra'id was he was a mentor that I still reflect on his leadership and his wisdom.
Thanks for sharing that. Are there strong connections between women's groups in the Middle East and North Africa, and are there any kind of internal tensions?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think about women groups are not homogenous groups. I mean, definitely they're not. Not every woman is a progressive woman. Not every woman is a feminist. So, for example, I'm right now reading a book by Butaina Shahban, and she talks about Damascus Diaries and how she only talks about Assad and the peace process and how Assad. So that kind of, like, you know, a state feminist like Butaina Shahban, or like a right-wing feminist, you know, this is also part of the women's movement in the region. You have a lot of also right-wing feminists and the uprising, of course. I mean, I'm very... this is how I see. I mean, yeah, I'm not very, I mean, that's a women groups that are, like, huge groups. There are a lot of groups. It just, in Syria, they're like over I don't know, like I cannot really count anymore. I mean, the last time I checked, there was over 150 groups. So it's just, you know, one of the groups I remember, they kind of, their goals was to combat homosexuals in Idlib. So you see what I'm saying? Like, it's just, there are different movements, there are different dimensions, there are different struggles, there are different discourses, really. And I would just, I would say, like, enjoyization of the movement is pretty much part of that. So definitely there are internal, like, they're different, you know. It's not just internal conflict. I would say it's more of political conflict, so more of, like, political different positionalities, you know, what kind of feminist or women movement that is going to advocate the rights of the stateless, the rights of refugees, the rights of single moms, of IDPs, of sex workers, you know, what kind of women's movement or feminist movement is working on also talking about the essential, you know, of Palestine as an essential kind of struggle.
Yeah, it seems to be that kind of complication everywhere. Can you talk about the relationship between the Syrian revolution and other international struggles, such as the Palestinian struggle?
Yeah, for some reason, there's a contested relationship between the Palestinian struggle and the Syrian revolution. And I think the opposition, Syrian opposition, they make it difficult. Because they're reactionary. I mean, a lot of the Syrian opposition, and I would say some of the mainstream revolutionaries, are a bit reactionary when it comes to Palestinian struggle, because they see it as, oh, like, how was Assad co-opted anti-imperialist struggle? He wanted to say that I am the person who would support Palestine. So you have to be okay with everything I do so that we continue supporting Palestine, or be anti-Zionism or anti-imperialist. And in doing so, he kind of, you know, there's no human rights whatsoever. Now, the Syrian opposition, they came and said, oh, okay, we don't want to talk about Palestine anymore. We don't want to talk about the centrality of Palestine. We don't care about Palestine. We care about us, Syria first. And even some of them would want to talk to Israel, and some of them went to Israel. And I would say some of the Syrian gays even went to Israel. And some of the Syrian gays in Berlin, they're also, practicing normalization kind of with Israeli artists and performers. So, I mean, it's really interesting that what Hafez al-Assad and Bashar did, they created a reactionary movement within the social movement towards Palestinian struggle. A lot of Syrians, I feel like, reactionary, kind of like really fed up with Palestinian struggle. And I think this is what's alarming. And this is the work of intellectuals that we need to do, is that we need to be very aware of what states they push us to kind of, because of their way they co-opt struggles, they push us to think about struggles the way that they do. And that actually made a lot of unfortunately, some of the Palestinians, like, just say, you know, Ali Abu Na'ma, for example, in Chicago, where I am right now. I mean, the way that his discourse, for example, is very problematic towards the Syrian revolution. So, because he is very much, you know, he believed the discourse of the Assad regime. He believed the state's discourse. He does not want to listen to people's discourse. So you have all of this kind of, you know, public figures in the Palestinian movement, unfortunately, that would believe what Assad is saying. And you have at the same time the Syrian opposition. They would be reactionary to what Assad is done and is doing. And you would have these two kind of not trying to push more of a collaborative kind of a solidarity discourse between the two struggles, are trying to really obstruct that sort of attitude. So this is why the work of grassroots is important here, and the work of intellectuals and artists and activists, is to kind of remember how our struggle is different. You know, it is different because, you know, settler colonialism is different from Assad, right? I mean, we're not to kind of say we're the same. But at the same time, because we live different struggles, because we have different oppressions, it is important that we have this solidarity. And I think that also this is something to work on, hopefully, in the future.
So what is to be done?
Personally speaking, I'm now looking at being a teacher. I feel like I have gained so much insight, and I have had been through experiences, and I've met so many amazing people the past 10 years. I've learned so much, and I've made so much mistakes that I'm reflecting on. I'm learning so much about self-care, learning so much about burnout and my limitations and my capabilities, and also self-love. And I have to thank a lot of the Black feminists who've been writing about these issues like long, long time ago. So I personally would say that, you know, just reading about other people's struggle, other people work, so that we learn how to communicate our struggle. And that's a lot of work, actually. And we need to be more creative, I feel, like, not just to kind of continue to produce I feel like there's a lot of repetition happening, and especially now with the 10 years of the anniversary, like, we're going to keep on continuing romanticization. Let's just continue celebrating the heroics of the Arab uprising. And I'm really at the point of, like, that's really nice, but let's just talk mistakes now. Let's just talk what can be done. How can we think about the kids that who have not experienced anything but camps so far? And we have so much youth that they're really struggling with paperwork. They're not even able to settle down, and they're not even to continue their studies. I'm really worried about the children and the youth of the region, and Syria and Yemen and Palestine and Lebanon and the region. And I think about them a lot. And I think this is one of the reasons why I want to be a teacher and why I'm doing my PhD, is because I wanted to bring all of this insight to academy. And academy has been it's been learning slowly about the struggle, but they are a bit stuck with their buzzwords. You know, Arab Spring and counterinsurgency, and so I'm just thinking about how to create different curriculums, how to create different knowledge production that is very closer to communities, to also give them tools to communicate their own struggles and how to like support their work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of building those connections. So, I mean, thanks for coming on the show and sharing where you're at with everything.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope I made sense. I feel like some of the stuff I said that maybe did not make sense.
Oh, it made a lot of sense. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand. It's we're in the process of figuring things out, and it was good to hear where you're at with that.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. So, as always, listeners, if you found this useful, please donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. Also, please drop a review at Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Solidarity, and we'll see you in the future.